Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Welcome, everybody. You're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and our show is available over on iTunes as well as on DogWorksRadio.com. You can search for us under the same name, Dog Works Radio, and if you get a chance, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. It helps out our rankings and allows people to find us over on the web. Calling in from Southern California today is our co-host, Alex Stein, and we're going to continue our Mushers series this evening. We're going to talk to Larry Doherty. He finished his first Iditarod just about a month or so ago, and he's calling in from Anchorage, Alaska, so we'll invite Alex first. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. Very excited to be back on the air with you, and very, very excited to be talking to our guest tonight.
Likewise. So Larry is calling in from Anchorage. Larry, how's it going?
Hey, guys. Hey, Robert. Hey, Alex. It's going great. Excited to talk to you guys tonight. Thanks for having me as a guest.
Well, thank you very much, Larry. I know that you're at your kids' concert, so we won't keep you too long this evening, but thank you for joining us to talk about your Iditarod experience. For folks that listen to our show during Iditarod coverage, you were one of the rookie mushers that we covered and talked quite a bit about on our show, so it's a pleasure to have you on. Larry, if you will, very quickly, tell us a little bit of a quick bio, who you are, what you're all about.
You betcha. So I live in Eagle River, Alaska, 40 years old. I'm married. I have five kids. I work as a radiation oncologist at Alaska Cancer Treatment Center in Anchorage, specialize in all different types of cancer. And I grew up mostly in the Denver and then the Seattle areas, Seattle since I was 13, and dreamed of doing the Iditarod really my whole life. Talked about the Iditarod on my very first date with my wife almost 20 years ago. And told her that someday I was going to move to Alaska and do the Iditarod. So it's just amazing to have done it.
Wow. For our folks that are listening, the way that we typically do this on our show is I will ask a question and then Alex will go. That way we don't have to constantly say who's talking, so you'll kind of get an idea of who is speaking on the air when. So we're going to jump right into this, Alex and Larry. Alex, or Larry, my first question is, tell us about your arrival to Alaska. Did you have a mentor on board when you came up? Were you working with somebody? Or did you just sort of just pack up the U-Haul like a lot of us did and work their way up here?
Yeah, it was really more the latter. You know, I knew I wanted to do the Iditarod. I had a great job offer up here. So relocated the family up here, but really did not have a concrete plan in place other than I knew I would do the Iditarod. And I was lucky and fortunate to meet Jim Lanier, who really served as my mentor through my qualifying races, and also was convenient because he lives in Chugiak. So worked with Jim during the first year and was introduced to Mitch Seavey through a mutual friend. And was blessed to work with Mitch for the actual Iditarod this last year.
Very good stuff. So, Alex, your first question for Larry.
So, Larry, first of all, congratulations on finishing the race. It's always very exciting when someone who is a rookie finishes, and especially someone who has a really inspiring story like you do. I was wondering just, what was your first exposure to Iditarod? Was it something that you were familiar with when you were growing up, or did you somehow meet someone who was involved in Iditarod, or how did it start for you?
Yeah, really for me, my first exposure, and thank you for the congratulations, by the way, I appreciate that. But my first exposure was as a small boy. I really think I was around the age of 10 or 11 years old. And my grandma, but actually both of my grandparents were just very, very into Alaska. They traveled up here frequently. If you were to visit my grandparents' home when I was a kid, their entire house was decorated in Native Alaskan artwork. They actually had a totem pole in their living room, and the front door of their home was a carved Native art door with a whale and an eagle on it. And that's just kind of the environment that I grew up in. I was very close to my grandparents. And when my grandparents visited, or when my grandma would write me letters, often around February, March, the Iditarod would be mentioned. I can remember her sending me newspaper clippings when Libby Riddles and then Susan Butcher won the Iditarod. And so somewhere along the line, that seed was planted. I also was into the Jack London novels, curse that guy. and just was fascinated with Alaska and the Great North and adventure, and also following my grandparents' adventures around the world. You know, they went to Antarctica in the early 1980s. So really that's kind of where the seeds were planted for me. And I set the goal, even as a young boy, that someday I was going to grow up and find a way to race in the Iditarod.
So Larry, I was reading through your bio before we went on the show on Iditarod.com. And of course it tells, you know, the story of how, you went to paramedic school and then went on to college and then went on to medical school to become a cancer doctor. How do those two careers, now that you are a professional Iditarod musher and also a cancer doctor up here in Alaska, I guess my first question is, how do you marriage those two? And it says here you have an awful supporting wife. And you know, that's one of those critical components of any mushing family. You have to have that support of the other one, the significant other, whomever that may be, whether it be husband or wife or whichever. Can you tell us about that, sort of the careers and also how you get that support from home?
Yeah, you bet. So I'll start with my wife. We've been married for almost 17 years now. I mentioned we have 5 kids, 3 boys and 2 girls. And, you know, there's not a lot of part-time mushers out there. Most folks that do this activity do it full time. It really has been an all consuming activity for me outside of work, holding down a full time job and then also finding the time to train and race for the Iditarod. It's taken all my vacation time and most every weekend. Just most of my spare time has been preoccupied with this activity. And then for my wife and family to uproot, where they were perfectly happy down in Florida, living a couple blocks from the beach, and follow Dad to Alaska to go after this dream. You really couldn't have a more supportive wife and family, and just been very fortunate that way. And I think part of that has been that's been part of the plan, for a long time. But also just I have an incredible family, so just very fortunate, very grateful for that. In terms of your career question. I have taken kind of a unique pathway. I was a paramedic and also a firefighter and then, you know, decided to go to medical school and ended up in oncology, which is, another story in and of itself. But how it relates to this activity and I think just really the larger question of following your dreams in general. You know, I've been confronted with people in oncology and also as a paramedic who are facing the worst day of their life, you know, on a very regular basis, receiving a cancer diagnosis or being involved in a traumatic accident. And I think something about seeing that over and over again and really confronting that every day at work probably has given me even more of an urgency to live every day to the fullest and not put off major goals and really has been a bit of an inspiration to me to really put some of these things at the forefront in my life.
Wow. That's compelling stuff there for sure. Alex, do you have a follow-up to that?
Yeah, Larry, we saw a lot of pictures of you, and it was mentioned in several articles that you had what appeared to be Tibetan prayer flags that you had with you on the sled. Could you talk a little bit about that and what that was all about?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. So as a resident going through oncology training, you know, I have a background in mountain climbing and rock climbing, and one of my best friends who was going through residency with me at the time was also an avid mountaineer, and we got into climbing together. And we were doing residency training together in Philadelphia at an inner city hospital, and we really served kind of the poor and the forgotten folks who were uninsured or imprisoned or homeless, who would get cancer diagnosis and have, you know, what I would call real cancer, you know, these very advanced cancers. You know, due to lack of education, lack of screening, we would get them at a very advanced stage. And some of these folks just didn't have a great social environment or support environment. And we wanted to do something to give some encouragement or support to these people. And so as we would go out mountain climbing, we would take these Tibetan prayer flags with us. And we just did a simple gesture of writing their names on the prayer flag. And we would take a picture at the summit. And it was just kind of when we get back from our trip, I was thinking of you type gesture to our patients. And we were surprised, quite honestly, at how meaningful this was to our patients. You know, many, you know, we could just really tell it was very meaningful to them. And so we actually created a nonprofit surrounding this idea. It's called Radiating Hope, with the idea that we would start to raise money through this Tibetan prayer flag idea. And with the money, we would increase access to cancer care in underdeveloped and developing countries. So we have ongoing work in Africa and around the globe. And essentially what we do is we take these flags with us to the tops of mountaintops around the world. I'm going with Kilimanjaro in Tanzania next month with my son on a climb like this. And I carried with me on the Iditarod prayer flags for my patients here in Alaska. Each of the patients that I've treated since I've been here, I wrote their name on a flag, and I gave them a copy of that flag when they finished their treatment. And I thought it was a fitting gesture, being in Alaska, to take those flags with me from Anchorage to Nome. So I was proud to get those there.
That's wonderful.
Good stuff there, Larry, for sure. So if we could, let's jump into the Iditarod. And since we don't have a lot of time, and I know you're a little pressed with the concert that you have to attend tonight, my first question is going to talk about probably the big media story concerning you early in the race.
Sure.
Where you guys got off track for a day or so. Can you tell us about that, how that happened, and how you eventually found out you were on the wrong trail and you had to turn around?
Yeah, you bet. So I thought that might be coming. So yeah, you know, started off in Willow. Just to back up a little bit, maybe, you know, I went to the musher meeting a couple days before the Iditarod and walked away, honestly, a bit discouraged. I mean, it really almost sounded like the trail was not doable with the message that I received. The report that we got, you know, just sounded like there was a lot of open water, that it was very icy, that the snow conditions were terrible. And, you know, I was very nervous that this was going to be a repeat of 2014 where there would be a lot of injuries and a lot of people scratching. And so I went into this, you know, a little bit nervous, but showed up Willow, you know, on the day of the race, just a beautiful day. And certainly the trail was hard and fast leaving Willow and pretty icy. It was a struggle to keep my team slowed down to an appropriate pace. I was trying to keep my team between, you know, really right around 8.5 miles an hour. But at the same time, I was just really caught up in, man, I'm in the Iditarod right now. This is amazing.
Right.
Lifelong dreaming and planning. And I admit maybe I was a little bit distracted, but, you know, had a great run from Willow to Yentna. And then again from Yentna to Squentna, but leaving Squentna is where things went wrong for me. About 7 miles outside of Squentna, there was a little turnoff. And, you know, frequently in that section of the trail, there's all these tiny little offshoots that are kind of little side trails. And much of the time, you know, these little side trails just lead back onto the main trail. And anyway, I thought that this little fork in the trail was just a little side trail, but it turned out it was not. I ended up on a completely different trail. It's what's called the Overland Trail, which really is the old Iditarod Trail. You know, I've been asked, you know, how did you not know you were going the wrong direction? If you look, you know, that trail was a well-worn trail. It had been used by several races, and it actually, being the old Iditarod Trail, has the old classic wooden tripod markers for the Iditarod, which just reinforced to me that I was going the right way. I knew that eventually I would have to be headed a different direction to make it up to the Rainy Pass area, but I just figured that the trail would circle around and I would head the right direction. But I did not know that I was going the wrong way until 35 miles later when I dumped onto the Yentna River.
If I could follow up real quick, Alex, before you get in with the next question, was this turn off for folks that are listening? First off, up there at that portion of Alaska, there are hundreds of trails, snow machine trails, mushing trails. Everybody is using them. So I found myself going off on the wrong trail on many occasions. So it is a very common problem, especially with different markers that are left there from many races in the past. But my question to that and the follow-up, Larry, was it dark when you guys took the wrong trail? Was it full board light? What was the weather conditions like when you kind of made that wrong turn there?
Oh, man, I wish I could chalk it up to that it was dark and I could see, but it was a beautifully clear day. I want to say I left Squintna mid-morning, maybe like 10 in the morning, but clear day, no visibility issues at all. I will say, you know, the junior Iditarod had gone through there, and the junior Iditarod markers are really exactly the same as the
right.
Iditarod marker, with the exception that they see junior on them. So I was seeing those junior markers. I was seeing the tripod markers. I'd also done the Northern Lights race, which I think – you know, went that way circuitously to get to Finger Lake. So, you know, I just, and then, you know, like I said, I was just kind of caught up in the experience. I just, you know, felt like it would eventually circle back and I'd head the right way. But yeah, no excuses on the visibility for sure.
Nevertheless, you made it back and you headed along the way. So Alex, what's the next one?
So, Larry, we've talked a bunch to people who have run yearling teams or puppy teams for some of the more established racers, and one of the things that they always say is that they had, you know, very strict instructions and a very clear run-rest plan when they were going in. And I'm wondering how well were you able to stick to your plan? And was there anything that came up that just completely knocked that out of the water?
Well, yeah, I think my detour early on knocked that out of the water. I cut maybe an hour of rest when I figured out that I had taken the wrong way and stopped to rest my team. But part of that was my dogs and I just weren't getting good rest. There were a lot of well-meaning folks who were coming to check on me. There was a snow machiner circling and a helicopter actually that was sent by the Iditarod that landed right by my team and just to check on me. So, you know, threw my race off a little bit early on, but I got back on schedule and you know, things turned out just fine.
So did you,
go ahead, Alex.
Sorry about that. Just to follow up quickly, did you wind up finishing approximately when you wanted to finish in terms of time?
No, I finished about a day late from what I had planned. If my race would have gone perfectly according to my pre-race plan, I probably would have finished in the low 40s as opposed to the low 60s. And at the end of the day, you know, I'm totally at peace with that decision. There were a lot of side benefits to that detour that we can talk about if you want, but you know, who really cares if you finish in the low 40s versus the low 60s?
Right.
Right.
So my question, if we could step back just a little bit, Larry, we're talking to Larry Doherty tonight here on Mushing Radio. Finished the Iditarod just about a month ago, his first Iditarod. He is also a cancer doctor up here in Alaska, been up here a couple of years, uprooting his family from the beaches of Florida to the northern climes of Alaska. So, Larry, if I could step back just a little bit, I always like to ask the rookies or the folks that are running Iditarod, you know, that first time, did you feel that you were prepared, whether it be through the qualifiers, through all the training, through the mentorships you had? Were you ready to rock and roll when you hit that trail and felt very good about, yeah, I'm going to do this, and, you know, the teams are firing all cylinders, and I think we're going to make it?
Well, let me just say, I think that nothing can really prepare you for going over the Alaska Range, going down the Dalzell Gorge, going over the burn. But I did. I did feel prepared. I mean, I'd done thousands of miles, both on a sled and on an ATV and in my qualifying races. I think I had been taught everything that I could have been taught. I mean, I've been trained by some of the best minds in mushing, and been exposed to a lot of different environments and experiences. So I don't think that I could have been better prepared necessarily as a rookie, but man, it's a different level actually experiencing it, for sure.
Right.
So Alex, we have about 8 minutes left before we got to go. What's the next question for Larry?
So Larry, what was it like for you traveling on the trail? Did you have a group of people that you were tending to travel with or near, or did you just sort of go all over the place and run into different folks in different parts of the trail?
Yeah, you know, my first third of the race was in pretty much isolation because I had dropped so far back and I was in dead last place. And then kind of as I started to gradually catch up to folks, I did start to see more of the mushers at checkpoints. I saw Mary Helwig and Kim Franklin and of course Patrick and, frequently, but we didn't necessarily plan on traveling together. Sometimes we did just when our schedules would coincide, but I had a pretty lonely Iditarod for the first third of the race or so.
So, Larry, can you tell us a little bit about your dogs? You know, we always talk so much about the mushers and their experiences, and I know you had mentioned that you had been working with the Seavies. So what kind of dog team did you have? Were they youngsters? Maybe tell us a quick story or two about a couple of your dogs, maybe the leaders, whomever you want to sort of showcase here on the show.
Yeah, you bet. So I really had a phenomenal dog team. I had what the Seavies would call the B team, and then Patrick Beal had the puppy team, which is the two-year-old dogs. But I had dogs that were excellent dogs, but not quite maybe cut out to make Mitch's A team. And really just a phenomenal group. I had plenty of qualified leaders. I will say that it's really amazing. You just learn so much more about your dogs over 1,000 miles than you do in a 300 mile race or than you ever could in training. Some of my best leaders that I depended on for shorter distances didn't necessarily get me through some situations that I needed, and some dogs that I never would have counted on in training were dogs that really showed up big for me. So that was really awesome to see. I think probably for me, really my most difficult run on the Iditarod was from White Mountain to Nome, that blowhole section. There were three of us that really got hit with some significant wind. And man, that was very, very challenging. And one of my leaders that, I had not really been able to call on for most of the race, I think she was just bored, on the river and some of the flat sections. I put her up there and she just really rose to the challenge. That was chilly and just pulled my team. And we were getting hit with just very, very fierce wind, and it was almost like she just needed a challenge and pulled us through that section. So I could tell you a lot of stories, but that was, to me, one of the most critical sections.
Good stuff. Alex, next question.
So, Larry, I always wonder when people have just finished their first Iditarod, was there ever a point where you thought to yourself, I can't do this? And the flip side of that is, when did you realize, wow, I'm actually going to finish this race? Was it when you were coming past safety or coming up on Front Street, or did you know, you know, before that?
Yeah, I think the only point that I had, you know, even when I took my detour, I didn't have any doubt that I would finish unless I was disqualified. My biggest fear was that I would be deemed not competitive and withdrawn from the race. But really, until I hit that run from White Mountain to Nome, there was never any doubt that I would finish. But that section was just so treacherous, so just beyond the pale. I did. I wondered if we were going to make it through. You know, it was dark and blowing, and we were getting blown out to sea and going over this just sketchy terrain, driftwood on the beach. I definitely would say it was when I got to safety that I pulled into that checkpoint and the wind died down and man, I was just overcome with emotion and knew at that point that it was very likely that I was going to finish the race.
So, Alex, do you have time for one final question, and then I'll ask the question I always ask the rookies?
Sure. And Larry, I want to preface this by saying I am not asking you to say anything that you're not supposed to say, and if you don't want to say anything, feel free not to say anything about this. But I know that a lot of us, a lot of fans and a lot of observers of Iditarod were understandably shocked by the snow machine attacks. And I was wondering if you wanted to say anything about how you found out about that or what your reaction to those events was.
I'm really glad you asked that question. Actually, I do want to say something because I think that, unfortunately, in the mushing community and definitely in the media, the word snow machiner has become a bit of a dirty word and a pariah. And I don't want to make certainly there's just no excuse for what happened to Jim or I'm sorry, to Jeff and to Allie. And I mean, there aren't words strong enough to condemn what happened. But my own personal experience with snow machiners on the trail was extremely positive. You know, when Patrick and I got lost, there were snow machiners, like I said, that came to check on us and make sure that we knew we were going the right direction. And these were just, you know, lay public folks who were probably following the race on their phones or their computers and made a special effort to track us down. I can remember coming up towards Finger once I was headed the right direction. There's a turnoff towards Tal Vista Lodge. And a couple of snow machiners, these really cool guys, late at night, I mean, it was probably midnight, had built this huge bonfire in the middle of that turnoff and had put their snow machines in the middle of that trail, you know, basically to prevent Patrick and I from making another wrong turn. I wouldn't have turned off there, but it was just a gesture. You know, as we passed them, you know, they gave me a huge pep talk and, you know, said, "Oh man, you're our favorite musher. Don't worry about it. You know, everything's going to be just fine." And there were numerous very positive experiences. You know, another one was two snow machiners, Michael McNamara and Steve Perrins. They on Rainy Pass helped me rescue Ajax, which was Mary Helwig's lost dog. And these guys took probably a couple of hours of their time. They were following this dog very responsibly from, you know, a couple hundred yards back to not scare him off and help me corral that dog. I also witnessed snow machiners rescue Kim Franklin's team and spend the night with that team and feed those dogs. So while there have been some very negative things that have happened with snow machiners in the mushing community, I personally had nothing but positives. So that's what I would say.
Excellent.
That's great news to hear for sure, and I'm glad you were able to share that with us tonight, because there has been so much negative connotations to that. And, you know, rightfully so, as you'd mentioned, of course, we don't know all the facts, and I don't know if we ever will. So we'll see how it works. You know, we're kind of bound by what happens in the courts. That's sort of our society. So I think it will be interesting to see what happens in the coming months. So first off, Larry, I know we're running real short on time, and I want to make sure you make it inside to the concert. But first off, on behalf of both me and I'm sure of Alex, we want to congratulate you on your finish. 11 days, 21 hours. Is that correct?
Yes.
So first off, yeah, again, thank you or congratulations for that. And then I have a question that I ask everybody that starts Iditarod as a rookie, is I ask them to give one piece of advice to those folks that are thinking about packing up that U-Haul, as you and many of us have, or those folks that have that dream, whether they're little kids as you were, or, you know, the middle-agers that are thinking about doing a bucket list type. What is that one piece of advice you can give to those folks?
Oh, man, I would just say do it. Seize the day, you know, go for it. If it's something that you really want to do, you know, do it. But do it with eyes wide open and realize, you know, this is an enormous amount of work. I think it's glamorized in the books and the movies. But, man, you spend a lot of time doing mundane things, you know, scooping dog poop and you know, a lot of time, you know, just out there sleep deprived. And so it's an enormous amount of work, but my goodness, how gratifying and just an amazing experience, you know, to have experiences, be out there in the interior of Alaska with you and your dogs and the Northern Lights are out. And, I mean, it doesn't get any better. It doesn't get more incredible. So to me, you know, the Iditarod met and exceeded all expectations that I had had. So if you're dreaming of doing it, if you want to do it, you know, go for it.
You know, Larry, it's interesting you say that. I had Noah Pereira on just the other night here on the show, and he was the youngest young man on the trail this year, just at 19 years old, and his advice was the exact same thing as yours. If you're going to have it, if you're going to have that dream, just get out there and do it. So I think that's kind of the consensus of everybody out there on the trail. Just go out there and follow your dreams and chase them and do what you can to finish them for sure. And you were one that, you know, that put a lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of distance, I'm sure quite a bit of money. Without the support of your family, friends, and folks at your job, I don't know if that could have been possible for sure. So, Alex, do you have anything in closing before we let Larry go?
You know, Larry, I just wanted to once again thank you for coming on and talking to us and just congratulate you. It's very inspiring to those of us who are just fans of the race to see someone who comes up as a rookie, you know, has maybe a little bit of trouble early in the race, but pulls through and finishes. And it is very inspiring. So thank you very much for talking to us and for sharing your stories with us.
Well, thank you guys for the opportunity to come on and thank you for your interest in the race. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Larry, before we close, do you have a website, a Facebook page, any way folks can follow you, not only this past race, but possibly adventures to come?
Yeah, you bet. I do have a Facebook page. It's called Iditarod Dreamer.
Very cool. Nice stuff. And you said you're going to Africa very soon to do to hike Kilimanjaro in a couple of months, right?
Yeah, next month, taking my son Calvin. He's 13. He and I will be carrying the prayer flags to the top of Kilimanjaro with about 40 other folks.
Awesome stuff. Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight. I hope we were able to get you to the concert in time for your child there. I know that's an important thing. You only get so many chances to see the little one shine, and I want to make sure you're able to see that tonight. So thank you again for joining us tonight. We'll pass over some links when it airs, okay?
Right on. Thanks so much, guys. You have a good night.
Thank you.
On behalf of my guest tonight, Larry Doherty, and my co-host, Alex Stein, we'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.